Thanks for downloading this episode of Cork Talk with me, Tim Atkin. A weekly conversation with some of the most famous people in the world of wine.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Nomacork by Vinventions. Driven by a commitment to innovation, the new plant-based Nomacork Green Line offers significant improvements in wine closure performance. Thanks to a rigorous oxygen ingress rate, you can decide which cork is best for your wine, whether it's for young and fresh wines or for those with aging potential.
Gerhard Kracker is widely regarded as one of the greatest sweet winemakers in the world, someone who's more than lived up to the achievements of his late father, Luis. I caught up with him to chat about botrytis, volatile acidity, unusual food matches, and what makes the Seewinkel such a unique place to grow grapes. Hi, Gerhard, how are you?
Very good. Hi, Tim. Good to talk to you.
It's lovely to talk to you. I know you're in Ilmit, which is where you live and where the winery is, obviously. But I think you just got back from the States, haven't you?
Yeah, just a week ago, I was on a 3 weeks trip, and it was the first time since 20 months traveling for me, which was really exciting.
Freedom.
Oh, yes, definitely. I've never been used since more than 20 years staying home that long. So it was not that easy, especially the first couple of months. And now I'm happy to be on the road again.
And how long do you usually spend traveling each year?
Oh, well, in a normal year, about 80 to 90 days, not in Austria.
Yeah, that's quite a bit, isn't it? 3 months.
Yeah. The longest I ever did was like 3 years ago, which was 140 days, not in Austria. Ooh. This was really a lot.
That's crazy. Listen, as ever, lots of stuff to talk to you about. I'm really glad to have you on Cork Talk. Going to chat about your family, about the styles of wine you make, about botrytis, about Austria, about all sorts of things. But I want to start with your granddad. We'll talk about your dad, Luis, in a minute. But I just want to ask about your granddad, who was Alois Senior, yeah, who founded this amazing winery in 1959. Could you just tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, sure. He unfortunately died in 2010, and he was the founder of the winery. And the winery was actually founded before 1959 as a mixed farming place after World War II, because it was a very poor area. We were at the end of the world. 5 minutes from us by car was the Iron Curtain. And my grandfather always said that before 1959, it was mixed farming. It was also a little bit of vineyards, like 0.5 hectares. But all he did during this time with wine was just for the money. And he always said from 1959 on, it was a winery. And quality came up to the expectations he wanted to make all the time before. And that's why we still say nowadays, the foundation is 1959. Yeah. And this man always had had the vision and the wish for being a winemaker, but couldn't fulfill for more than 15 years, because when he started in 1945, right after World War II, he was about 16 years old. He was born in 1928, and he was a kid of nine, and the family was very poor, with a small house and a little bit of land to feed ourselves. That was basically it. And he always had the dream of being a winemaker. He always told me he really hated farming. He didn't want to do it. He just did it for surviving. You know, we were a typical mixed farming place, which was very normal in the area. We had everything from, we had two cows, we had a couple of pigs, chicken, and he grew everything from the garlic to the pickle to the corn, and everything they didn't have to exchange with the neighbor. So they had food, but no money. And vineyard land was more expensive. Planting vineyards was very expensive. So it took him very long, because in the beginning, all he did was selling grapes. And then he made one barrel for home drinking, for selling to a few consumers. And then he found that winemaking is the thing he wants to do. He always said being on a field was like hell, but being in a vineyard was like a dream. And he always said he saw that winemaking is something more than just simple farming. It's it's an art. And it took him until 1959 to fulfill that. And he saw already the potential of that area with this special microclimate to produce world-class sweet wines, which he wasn't always able to do because, especially in the beginning, also after 1959, he had to produce also low-end wines to get money back faster because working with Botrytis is a lot of work, costs a lot of time and a lot of money, and he couldn't always afford to go up to the highest quality.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, you studied economics, didn't you, for a little while before you got involved with the family winery? And you were what? You were 21 when you joined in 2001. I mean, was there ever a possibility you were going to become an economist or a pharmacist like your dad was?
Well, in the beginning, yes, but the studies I only started because it was a wish of my father. My father was born in 1959, and as said, there was the winery found. And his older brother was very, very good in school, so he was the one who was allowed to study. So they couldn't afford sending a second kid for studying to Vienna. So my father was never able to study, and that's why he wished always for me that I can have my studies in Vienna. And in the beginning, I was in an economics school, starting when I was 15 or 16. And before I finished that, I found my way into winemaking already, because when I was before 18, I went to my father and said, you know, that I need more pocket money. You know, I'm making my driving license now, I want a car, and, you know, I'm going out and my pocket money is not enough. And he said, well, this is no problem. We have work enough. So I started to wash barrels, wash tanks after school on Saturdays. I was helping. And then when I got the driving license, I was the driver for my father when he went to interviews, to dinners, to wine shows. And then I got to know a lot of very interesting people from the wine world. Got to taste fantastic wines, including my father's wines, which I didn't really know until that. And then I said to myself, wow, that's a pretty amazing job. And I even loved the barrel washing or labeling or whatever work I had to do, or driving the tractor. And so I got a passion for that.
So you became a winemaker.
So I became a winemaker. Yeah. Well, not in the beginning, because my father always told me, you have to finish your studies because you have the chance to do it. And afterwards, you can do whatever you want, being a winemaker or not. Doesn't matter, just finish your studies. So I started my studies and always came back to the winery very often to work in the winery. And after 2 years of studies, I made the whole harvest here and traveled a couple of times, especially to Asia for my father because he had no time. So I took that opportunity. And after about 4 or 5 months, my dad said on a lunch to me, you know, I really appreciate your work and I'm very happy that you're so passionate about everything. And but I would love that you go back and finish your studies. And I said, you know, I can't. And he said, why not? I said, yeah, no, I'm not inscribed anymore since more than 3 months. I can't go back. It's done. And well, then we didn't talk for about 3 or 4 months. But in the end, it was a very good decision because finally I had to take over at a very young age. And if I would have finished my studies, I wouldn't have seen that much before my father died. So somehow in the world, everything fits on decisions you make, even when you don't think in the beginning it makes sense.
I mean, we've talked about your father, who was amazingly famous and charismatic, and he made his own winery into one of the most famous in Austria, but also one of the great sweet wine producers of the world. As you said, you know, he died very young, in 2007, which meant that you took over at the age of 27. I mean, it must have been a huge challenge to follow somebody like that, because he was, you know, he was very charismatic. He was famous, not to say you're not charismatic, but it's tough as a 27-year-old, isn't it, to take over from somebody like that?
It was kind of my luck was that since the start in 2001 that I learned very fast and I had a very hard school from my father and from my grandfather. So I had the big chance to work with two generations having the same target, but with different ways to go there. They were two completely different generations. And I always picked from both what I thought is best. And so I was very, very well prepared. And I had the big advantage that most of the people, except a lot in Asia and a little bit in the US, most of the wine people didn't know me really. So it was an advantage that most people had no expectations.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, let's talk a little bit about where you are, because you're in this incredible place, as you said, particularly for sweet wines. I read you recently saying that with our climate, there's no such thing as light, zippy wines. Can you tell us a bit about the Seefinkel and what makes it such a unique place to grow grapes?
Well, you know, we have this very special microclimate, which comes from our national park. I'm living in the middle of this beautiful national park called Neue Siedler See. It's named after one of the biggest lakes in Europe. It's also called Neue Siedler See, Neue Siedler Lake. Neue Siedler is a town and See means lake. And it's 36 kilometers long, 3 kilometers wide, and just about, at the moment, I just checked it yesterday because I knew we have the interview today, 1 meter 20 centimeters at the deepest point right now.
And that's about 4 feet, yeah?
That's about 4 feet. Yes, yeah. That's about 4 feet. So that's I can walk through very easy. And but that's the lowest point in the last couple of years. We had a very dry season now. And in winter, it fills up by rain. And then it's up to 6 feet, 6.5 feet. But that's regular. That's very normal. And this makes a lot of our climate. That gives a lot of humidity because the water gets very warm. So we get great humidity, especially when we need it, means end of September, beginning of October, for the botrytis to get started. And then what makes Illmitz, our hometown, so special is that we have a lot of small lakes, small pots, if you would say it like that, very small, very shallow. They are between 5 and 30 centimeters deep. And there is around 20. I always say around 20 because always some of them are dried out. Yeah. Their main source is rainwater. And when it doesn't rain like now, they are all dried out. But before the botrytis comes, normally they fill up again with rainwater. And then we have that really huge amount of humidity. And that's what makes Illmitz to the heart of botrytis wine production.
And it's pretty flat, isn't it?
It's completely flat.
I mean, I know your dad used to joke about the mountains of Illmitz, which were a meter high.
Yes. it's completely flat. And also that helps for the botrytis to grow perfect because in the morning hours, end of September, beginning of October, we've always fog in our vineyards because it's so humid and the day and night temperature differs so much. So it's always very humid. It's, I mean, really, really humid. You can cut it in front of your face. And during the day, as everything's flat, there is some wind coming, which brings out that fog because it's so thick that the sun couldn't destroy the fog.
Yeah.
And with that wind, that brings it out. And then we have a clear, sunshiny day. And that's the perfect combination for the botrytis to grow. And our area is so special that since 1959, there has been no vintage without botrytis production and no vintage producing up to the highest quality, to the TBA. And this is unique. No other area can say that, not even Tokaj or Sauternes.
No. Neither of those two has it every year to that extent. I mean, you've got about 60 hectares of vineyards, haven't you? So your grandfather would be very proud, I think. And you've got these two soil types, haven't you? You've got gravel and you've got sand. So two-thirds gravel, one-third sand. Just tell us how they differ.
The sandy soil was brought by the lake and it's next to the lake. So the vineyards on the sandy soil, you can see the lake from the Karoo, from the vineyard. And the gravelly soil is about 3 to 4 kilometers further away from the lake. And this was the end of the lake until 2000 years ago. And the lake always moved back slowly. And in the old days, my grandfather has chosen these two Karoos, these two vineyard places, because we said already everything's flat here. It's not 100% true, because these two grooves are between 0.5 meter and 2.5 meters higher than the rest. And as in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, it was much, much colder than now. It was always the worry of the winter frost destroying even the rootstocks, or spring frost, which we nowadays don't have that much trouble anymore. And my grandfather planted there because of that, because the cold is always sinking down. And this was a little bit higher. He was more safe. From a nowadays aspect, it's a little different because in these two points, there is the most mineralic components and the most salt, because it was the end of the lake on one hand for 2,000 years and before for 2,000 years, and on the other hand, on the new, on the sandy soil, since 2,000 years. And all this minerality and salt was always brought by the lake and is still there. And the plant takes everything from the soil, gives it to the berry, and when I have done my job right, it's also showing the wine. And that brings a lot of complexity, that brings a lot of freshness. We are a very warm area. I mean, we can have in summer up to 40 degrees Celsius, which is a lot.
And, so it's good to have both, right? It's good to have both sand and gravel, because you get different characters.
And also the minerality and saltiness. It makes your mouth feel acidity where it isn't. It brings a lot of freshness. Yeah. And with the two soil types, it's like working in two different areas.
Interesting.
Still being in the same village, because with the sand, when the sun shines on the sand, it gets so hot that you can't even walk barefoot on it. But as soon as the sun is gone, within 3 minutes, the sand is cold. So during the night on this cruise, we have between 1 and 3 degrees less. The gravelly soil absorbs the energy the whole day and gives it back in the evening hours. So it's two complete different effects.
Very interesting.
And most of our wines are a blend of these two soils, because we keep every lot, every harvest day extra for fermentation and aging. And even if it's single varieties, it's always coming from different plots. And most of the time, in 99% of the cases, it's in the end a cuvée, a blend of these two crus,
because
then you get more complexity.
Let's talk a little bit about botrytis, because, I mean, noble rot. I mean, hilarious, it's called noble rot. It looks horrible, I think, when you see it in a vineyard. It looks really disgusting. If you show it to somebody on a bunch of grapes, they say, well, horrible, but it makes these amazing sweet wines. I mean, you said you get it every year, but does the intensity differ from year to year? You know, what makes a great botrytis year? Is it wet? Is it more humidity?
Well, that depends. You can't say it that way, because when you look on 2017, 18, and 19, and even also 20, it was 3 years which were very dry and very, very hot. But we had the luck that the rain came at the right point, right when the dry vine harvest was over. Mid-September, third week of September, it started a raining period. And then we had enough humidity that the botrytis came fast. And the faster the botrytis comes, the faster the berries shrink in, the more freshness you still have. So we had vintages where you would think it's not good for botrytis. It was too warm, it was too dry. But at the end, it was fantastic vintages. So you can't say it that way. If the first half of the year is very wet, it doesn't mean that the botrytis is showing up then in October as we want to see it. So it's always depending. There is no real formula.
There's no recipe.
No. Yeah, every year new.
And how long does a typical harvest last? I mean, you're picking over months, aren't you? Sometimes it requires a lot of patience, I'd have thought.
Well, it is. I mean, sometimes at the end, I always say, okay, it's time that it's over. As much as I love harvest, you know, in the beginning, I'm always very excited, and it's the most favorite time of the year for me. But, you know, our normal harvest is from beginning of October for the sweet wines. We start with dry wines first to second week of September. But for sweets, it's beginning of October until at least Christmas, and sometimes even until mid of January. Because we have all these different selections. You have to know that botrytis does not come to every berry, to every rootstock, to every vineyard at the same time. It's a fungus. So it only goes to ripe, to overripe berries. And botrytis is a living thing. It's very weather sensitive. And that's why we make all these selections, because we could also wait until mid to end of November and harvest the whole vineyard as it is as a TBA. That's possible here. We would have the concentration. But as botrytis is so weather sensitive, in its perfect way, in its fresh way, it's a light gray. It's like a fur on the berry. Destroys the skins, and then the water part evaporates. When it's hanging too long and it didn't like the weather. Whatever, too hot, too dry, too wet, too cold, everything can happen. And they will dry these dyes and it gets dark gray to black.
That's
and
bad.
Then you have still the concentration, but the taste is not what we like, not what we're looking for. If you taste our wines, they are always full of freshness and fruit. And in a lot of school books, it's described, but dried this tastes like toasty bread and mushroomy. You will never find it in our wines. That's not the great Botrytis. That's harvested too late.
That's the enemy.
Yes, that's what we throw away.
Yeah, okay. And how many times could you pick one vineyard? 10, 15, 20?
Not that much. In a regular year, up to 5 times, but can be also when it's really bad and there is break periods or Botrytis doesn't go on as we wish, can be to 8, 9 times even. Yeah.
Eight or nine times. That's a lot of times, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
I was going to say, you make two different categories of sweet wine, don't you? This Zwischen den Seen and Nouvelle Vague. I mean, just tell us about the difference between the two, because it was something your dad created, wasn't it? Really, these two camps, if you like, these two groups of wines.
This was done in the end of the 80s by my father, and it was only the differences were only made in the collection wines. That means in the TBAs, everything with gold label and a number on it, in the highest quality we produce. And Zwischen den Seen means between the lakes. And it's kind of a homage to our area, to the big lake and to the small lakes, which makes it possible to produce these wines every year. And this is the more under bricks classical style. That means no use of barrique barrels.
Right.
That means fermentation and aging in stainless steel or in big, long-term used neutral casks. And these are varieties where we think the primary aromatic should be in front, like Scheurebe, Welschriesling, or Muscat. And the second style, which was started by my father, first experiments already end of 70s, beginning of 80s, fermentation and aging of sweet wines in barrique barrels, because he has learned a lot in Sauternes, and he always loved these wines. And barrique barrel fermentation and aging was not really known in Austria until beginning of 19th in the end. Before that, it was said that it's a mistake, it's influencing the wine too much, but with the micro-oxygenation through a new barrique barrel, you get the secondary aromatic in front. And after decades, he made his own formula, which we still use, that we would love to have the secondary aromatic in front on varieties like Chardonnay, like Tramina, or red sweet wines.
Okay, so they're richer wines in a way, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And your collection wines that you just mentioned, they're numbered, aren't they? They go from 1 up to 9, is it? Or sometimes more. What's the highest?
Sometimes even more. The highest we ever did was 1995, there we had 15 different wines.
Okay.
And we numbered them because we have all these different varieties. We have Scheurebe, Welschriesling, Tramina, Muscat Ottonal, Rosin Muscatel,
Zweigelt.
Zweigelt, yes, yes. just to don't forget something. And it's a lot of different varieties. And everybody's talking nowadays on diversity. We have it since 3 generations, in 60 years. It's usual for us. And we number our wines because this collection is something very special. First of all, most of these varieties show up every year.
Yeah.
If possible. And sometimes we have 2 or 3 versions of the same variety within a vintage because the characteristics are so different that we wanted to leave them alone. And therefore, we numbered the wines. That it's for everybody easier to make the difference.
And the higher the number, the sweeter the wine, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Every vintage numbered from 1 up to whatever how many we could do. The higher the number, the higher the concentration does not mean the better the wine. It's just an indicator of concentration within a vintage.
And do you like working with all these different grapes? I mean, as you said, it's quite baffling. You've got all these grapes going out there, some of which are unique to you. I mean, you're the only people who make sweet wine with Rosen Muscatella, aren't they?
Yes. In Alto Adige there are some, but in Austria we're the only ones.
I mean, are they all equally well suited to making sweet wines?
Kind of, yes, but you know, there's differences. Like Muscat Ottonal has very thick skins, so it's harder to get them fully botrytis than get them every year to the highest concentration. Or also with red varieties, there is also the skin sicker, so it's not as easy, but in our area it works. And I've been asked very often if it wouldn't be easier to concentrate on one, two, or maybe three varieties. And I always say, which one should I kick out? I love them all. If you can make wine like this out of all these varieties, why should you do that and kick one out?
It's like having 10 children. Like having 10 children. But you've only got two, haven't you? But...
Yes. Well, I always say my wines are also like my kids. So...
But your favorite? Is Riesling your favorite? If you had to choose one.
Well, I can't. They're all my kids, and you never choose one kid, you know? It's, and it's also very hard. It depends also on my mood. It always depends on the time of the year, what I prefer to drink. And most of all, it comes out that at the end of the harvest, my favorite one is always the one I had to work the most for it. To get it great.
Ah, and the hardest to make.
It's always like, yes.
So the hardest to make is your favorite.
Yes, yes.
How interesting.
And that's each year different. So
You like a challenge.
I do.
Tell me there's one story you told me once that you call your Scheuerreber, right? And some people in Austria call it Semling 88, don't they? Achtung, is that right? There we go. God, my German. I've remembered a bit of German. Is there a reason why you don't like to call it Semling 88?
Yes, because there are different stories about how this variety was crossed. And the story is the original one, that it's called Semling 88, because it was the 88th try of Dr. Scheu to create this variety. And this was the best one. But there's also a story which is not officially known. 88 is the eighth letter in the ABC is H, and 2x H means Heil Hitler. And that's the unofficial story, which could be true too, I don't know, but as 88 means that, I would never use that. And there was also the story that that should be at the end, after World War II, that should have been the Hitler Rebe.
And, was Dr. Scheu a Nazi then? Do we know?
We don't know, really. I don't know. I assume so. He had a party book, because without that, he couldn't have been professor officially. So, yeah. Mm. If he really was, nobody knows. And, I mean, the variety is fantastic, and it's not the variety's fault to be named like that. So, but I would never write the two signs of 88 on my bottle as... I don't want to give that fame, you know, so that's why we always use the Scheuerreber and never Semling 88.
Scheuerreber is a nicer word than Semling 88, isn't it? Achtung,
that's also, yes. Yes.
I mean, we've heard some of the challenges that you have in making sweet wines. One of the big things that we've not really talked about is volatile acidity, that slightly vinegary character, which you tend to get more in sweet wines, don't you? You'll maybe tell us why. I think probably because the yeasts are under stress, really, with so much sugar. How do you keep it under control? And do you like a bit of VA in your wines? You like a bit, don't you?
You have to have, because all components, when you concentrate something, are getting higher within the berry. Everything. So it also has to be the VA. So everything needs to be in balance. So a certain level of VA, certain level higher than in a dry wine is needed, that this wine is in real balance. But it's coming automatically through the shrinking in. The VA is automatically at harvest time already higher as in a dry wine. And it can happen if you haven't sprayed well, or if some bees or wasps were eating on your grapes before harvest, that it gets volatile and then you can throw all that away, which happened also to us, especially with red varieties, because I do fermentation for at least a week with the red TBAs on the skins in harvest boxes of 400 kilograms. And it happened from time to time that we threw away full boxes, because when the VA through fermentation starts to rise, until the point you really taste it and feel it, it's too late. It's done. You can't work with it anymore. It's vinegar.
You can taste the VA in the grapes, can you?
Not when it starts. Normally, you know, it's in there. It's a few berries which were eaten on by bees or by wasps. And in the mash, you don't see that and you don't taste that. Impossible, because it's all in a mash. Mm. And we try to sort before in the vineyard. And sometimes when you oversee something, you are done. Because with fermentation, that VA rises like hell then. And at the point when you really feel it, it's too late. It's so high that it's vinegar, so you can throw it away. That happens every 3-4 years with one or two boxes to us, and there's nothing else we can do.
So you just have to select the berries very carefully in the vineyard, yeah?
Yes, yes. Everything in the vineyard, because when you have these berries in the box and you select again on the sorting table, it doesn't matter anymore because the juice is out already.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah.
And the VA is on the other berries. So, yeah.
Listen, I want to talk to you a little bit about selling wine, really. I mean, you know, your dad was very good at marketing and PR. You are as well, as everybody can hear. You're a warm and friendly personality, and you're very knowledgeable. I just wonder, you know, people not having as many long lunches these days, we're all worried about being fat and all those sort of things with calories. Is it getting harder to sell world-class sweet wines? I mean, is the market shrinking a bit?
I think the total market is definitely shrinking, but for all alcohol, for all wine. But I think the world class is always getting through that, because people are thinking more on what they're drinking. They don't drink that high amounts anymore, but they're more selective. They want fantastic wines. And we are exported nowadays in 61 countries. And I know with all that calorie counting and all that stuff, there's a lot of wine left out nowadays. And I always tell people, look, if you drink a Cabernet Sauvignon from Napa Valley with 16 alcohol, it has the same amount of calories as a BA.
Yeah.
It's the same. And for the body, it doesn't matter if it's fermented sugar or non-fermented sugar. It doesn't matter. And that's a point which a lot of people are not aware of it. And always when I'm on the road, and also in nowadays in Zoom interviews and Zoom tastings, I always tell people, look, if you had a big dinner, a very big dinner, and you don't want to have a real big dessert anymore, just make it liquid. Just drink a glass of sweet wine. That's the easiest. That's super. Or just a piece of cheese with it. That's what I'm doing very often when I have big dinners with 10 courses and I don't feel like having a sweet dessert anymore. I just drink the wine. And that's very pleasant, because that doesn't feel heavy. And you're enjoying it because the aromas are fresh. And especially now during lockdown, I was watching a lot of TV and I found a combination which I've never thought about. I was drinking a glass of sweet wine, watching TV. My kids are very young. They are 4 and 7. They were asleep already. So I watched alone downstairs in the living room. And I wanted something salty. I was looking at the whole kitchen, nothing really there. So I made me some salted popcorn with the sweet wine. That was amazing. That's my new favorite pairing.
With which sweet wine? You need to tell us which one you have with the salted popcorn.
At this time, I had a Grand Cuvée TBA 2015. So it was
very
a
nice, quite
sweet one. But, you know, with the saltiness, it works a lot. And it's fantastic. And most of the time, especially in summer, I prefer something salty to sweet wine instead of something sweet. In winter, it's the other way around. But in summer, I have very often cheese to my sweet wine. What I also love is I read it a couple of years ago in an old book that the French, the people from Bordeaux, when they went to Arcachon, they had oysters and sauterne. And first they thought, that can't be good, no. And the day after I read that, I went to Switzerland, to Zurich, and told this to my importer. And he said, well, there's across the street, there's an oyster bar. Let's get some oysters and try that. And we were blown away. It was fantastic.
It was good.
You know, the sweetness with the saltiness and the texture of the oyster, it's amazing.
That's two new food and wine pairings you give me today. Listen, I want to ask you another thing, because you travel a lot. I wonder if there's anywhere else in the world you'd like to make wine. And your dad had various joint ventures around the world, as well as in Austria, didn't he? Have you continued with those joint ventures or not?
No, but I have new ones. I have one with Aldo Song, who is an Austrian guy who lives in New York, and he was world champion sommelier in 2008. And we are very, very good friends since more than 15 years. And when he won the world champion sommelier trophy, we met a couple of weeks later, and he said, "You know, Gerd, I'm always criticizing wine, but I never made one. Can we do that together?" I said, "Actually, that's a good idea, because then we can spend more time together. But we have to find something not being in my area, because when we do that, the wine will taste like me, because I'm the guy in the cellar. We need to go somewhere where I didn't make wine. We need to find a variety which I never made." So finally, it ended up that we moved up north to the Weinviertel, next to the Czech Republic border, to produce Grüne Veltliner there. And we started in 2009, and nowadays it's basically its own winery.
It's dry,
dry. We make four different wines, all dry. And basically now it's its own winery. And we started with one barrel just for fun. And we said, if people drink it, it's good. If not, we will drink it. And so it turned out to be, you know, we went there open-minded. A lot of people say it doesn't taste like typical Grüne Veltliner. But that wasn't our target. Our target was making fantastic wines as we think they should taste. We didn't care about tradition or anything like that, because I've never made a Grüner and Aldo never made wine. So we went there completely open-minded and did what we thought. And it turned out to be good.
I've got to try that. I wasn't going to try it with the salted popcorn. I'm going to try it something else. Listen, final question. You've got a very busy life. You know, you're running the family winery with the help of your wife, Yvonne, and your mother, Michaela. You've got two young kids, as you said. What was it, 4 and 7 or 4 and 8? And now you've started traveling again. You've got these other projects. How do you switch off? I mean, do you need to get away from wine sometimes? Do you like music? Do you like walking? Do you like reading? Do you do none of those things? Do you like eating salted popcorn, watching films? I don't know.
I have a lot of interests. I mean, I do cycling when I have time. That got less since I have kids. That's why I gained more than 10 kilograms, especially during pandemic. But just last week when I arrived back from the US, I went with my son for fishing. I love fishing since I'm a little kid, and I didn't practice it that often anymore. So Monday afternoon, it was 37 degrees Celsius. We went fishing because I told my son the day before, and he didn't stop because it's his summer holidays. He wants to go fishing. So I went with him. We were sweating like hell, and we didn't catch any fish, because the problem is when it's that hot, the carps are not biting that easy. So no chance. So we had to go the next day again, and finally we got one. 3 kilo carp. It was fantastic. And I was so happy, because I didn't want to go a third day in a row for fishing on 37 degrees.
That is very, very hot indeed, isn't it?
It is. It is.
So you got your carp. That was fantastic news.
That was amazing.
What did you drink with it?
Well, we didn't have it yet. My uncle prepared it and freezed it in, because we always had guests the last week. So we didn't make it, but it will be made on Tuesday. And we will get it deep fried, which is very tradition for here, with potato salad.
Sounds delicious. Wish I were there to have it with you. Anyway, it's lovely to see you.
Next time you're coming,
I'll be there.
My guest.
All right, it's lovely to talk to you. I have great memories of your dad, who is a dear friend of mine as well. You got the same sense of humour and wonderfully warm personality. Love the wines you're doing. I'd hope to see you soon in Austria, the UK, who knows where, the States. It'll be soon.
You know, we have a little guest house now, which we just opened 3 months. Be my guest.
It's got my name on the door.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Tim. Thank you. It was nice talking to you.
And you. Bye.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'd never realised quite how much work goes into making world-class sweet wines. Next week on Cork Talk, my guest is Filipe Pato from Bairrada in Portugal. See you then. Thanks for listening to Cork Talk. If you want to read more reports, articles and tasting notes by me, go to my website, timatkin.com. You can also follow me on Twitter @TimAtkin and on Instagram @TimAtkinMW. See you next week.